Welcome back to Around the Prompt. This is Logan Kilpatrick. Today we're joined by Quinn Slack, the CEO of Sourcegraph. We talk about how code search is fundamental to automating coding, why we don't need AGI to build great products, the future of programming, and much more. Quinn has an incredibly unique perspective on the ecosystem, so I hope you enjoy this conversation. Quinn, you want to take us back and tell us about sort of starting Sourcegraph to begin with? Like, what was the initial conviction behind specifically code search? Like, why was that something that was an interesting problem to solve?
Well, I've been a developer all my life. I've worked in massive code bases, was working in patches to Chromium and Firefox and OpenSSL. And then along with my co-founder, we were working inside of JP Morgan and Bank of America, and they had so much code. And in all of these settings, it was so hard to figure out, how does this work? Or if I change this, what's going to break? And we wanted to have some kind of code search, like Google for code. So in some of these open source projects, this was back in 2009 and before, I set up Open Grok, which was a code search that was made at Sun Microsystems and, you know, now Oracle. And it was, you know, okay. But when I got into these companies and these massive code bases, they didn't have anything like that. So we wanted to go solve that problem for ourselves because it's just so damn hard to get anything done. My co-founder had been at Google, and they have famously this amazing internal code search called Code Search. It's like a Google for code. You'd expect them to be quite good at that. And so we felt the problem ourselves. We knew that there was a solution, and we thought it'd be really fun to build because it'd be solving a problem for ourselves. And whenever you can get that really tight feedback loop that you're solving a problem for yourselves, then you just build the best product and you move so much faster. So we started out by building Code Search. We started Sourcegraph in 2013, and our first product was Code Search, like a Google for all the code in a company. And we made just about every mistake you could make along the way, but we built an awesome product that tons and tons of devs love. We have a lot of the FANG companies as customers. We have the US government. And it's just really cool to now look at our phone, for example, or look at our browser history and realize that we power the devs that build so many of the products that we love and use.
I love that. Was AI always a part of, I'm guessing like to a certain extent, AI was involved in the mix of how you were doing code search, but like, was that always something that you were sort of striving to push towards, or did this kind of, you right place at the right time and you had a bunch of the foundation in place and the recent excitement about AI just helped sort of push you even further?
Yes and no. We had a grand plan when we started the company in 2013. And first, it was basically build code search, build a global graph of all the code. And then the last step was intelligent automation, which is IA. At the time, if we had said AI, then I think people would have laughed us out of the room. So we knew that gathering all this data about the code and data from all these other tools that know things about code, like does it pass the tests? Does it actually run in production? What are the logs? All these things, getting all that in one place, that would be necessary to do any kind of automation beyond what existed at the time. And also getting all the devs in a company using something is important. You got to have that distribution because that is critical for getting more data about what devs are doing to fix code. And also, if you build a great product and you don't have tons and tons of devs using you all the time, then, you know, have you really built a great product? Can you really actually roll it out to them? And so we knew that it would position us really well. We had no idea about the timeline. I think there's a lot of people that kind of crawl out of the woodwork and say that they saw it all coming. We didn't, but we knew that this general direction would set us up really well. And in the meantime, it would not be us building off in the wilderness. It would be solving a real problem that we felt, that tons of other companies felt. And the thing that was so surprising to us is nobody else was going and building code search. It felt like not only a huge opportunity, but also something that would be such a fun project for every dev to go and build. It turned out to be a lot harder than we thought. And that's why we started the company in 2013. And today the year is 2024, and definitely a lot harder, but we're really happy with where it took us.
And is code search like still the direction that you're trying to put? Like, is there still like a bunch of unsolved problems in code search, or is it like you've sort of built the foundation of code search in the last 10 years? And like now that you have that foundation, that is like sort of the building block of the next part of the master plan, if you will, that you set out with in 2013. And now it's really focused on let's go and automate stuff based on all the understanding we have of your code.
Well, search and AI chat really blur together. From the user's perspective, what they want is a box that they can type shit into and it solves their problems. And that's what you want for general purpose search as well. That's with Google, you search and you see the AI overview at the top, and that feels so natural. And that's like probably the 100th kind of thing like that. Previously, it was images and travel and shopping. You know, you want one box, and Google calls it one box. Perplexity has done an amazing job of building a product where, is it search? Is it AI? You know, not really sure, but it goes and solves your problem. And that's what we want to do. Now, with code, every single domain is different. And with code, it turns out there was an application of LLMs to code that was before chat. And so if we didn't have really awesome autocomplete, really awesome inline edits with Cody, our code AI product, then I think it would just confuse people. But search is our bread and butter, and search is basically the thing that if you got a question about the code or you wanted to generate a bunch of code, you know, you just want one box to go and type that into and solve that problem. So we are unifying Cody's chat and search into one. And that is, I think, you know, the future.
I guess kind of going back to, or I guess starting with the end users of Source Graph, you know, when building it out, you know, were there any kind of shocking discoveries as launch as far as different industries or different domains or even, you know, different personas and positions that were leveraging the technology more so than maybe you originally thought?
Well, we found very quickly that you had to have a lot of code to get value from code search. And that meant that a lot of companies where they initially sell to their friends, 7-person companies, that route was not open to us because our friends, 7-person companies didn't have a lot of code. The companies that had enough code at the time, they saw us, a tiny little company, they'd get to that GitHub OAuth screen that says, do you want to send all your code to these randos? And they would bounce there. So it drove us to focus on much bigger companies. Our first customer was Uber, and next customer was Twitter, and these kinds of companies, which actually was incredible, because what we've seen is most developers are employed by bigger companies, by companies that have a lot of code. And getting that insight into how all the big banks, all the big tech companies, and so on, all across the world code has been just such a competitive advantage for us. But another really cool thing is the way that they code is not that different, you know, across industries. The Java code that GE writes to test jet engines is not that different from the Java code that, you know, for example, Grab might write to make it so that the car comes to you if you need a ride in Singapore. And that is one of the beauties of code. With so much other kinds of data, there's so much diversity. It's unstructured, but code is, you know, fundamentally structured, and it's quite similar. There's a finite number of languages, finite number of frameworks. And that, I think, is why AI has had the most success as an actual end user product on code, because it does have that structure and it does have that kind of broad audience that generally does some pretty similar stuff.
Yeah. And speaking about that success, was sort of the introduction of Copilot something that was surprising for you all as you were sort of on this code search journey and ultimately getting to the automation piece of that? Was that something that was surprising? And have you also, like, in line with that thinking, I think some of the conventional wisdom has been like, well, you know, GitHub has the world's code, so like, why would we want to compete against GitHub? And I think now they're actually seeing a bunch of sort of Copilot level competitors. And I think Cody probably slots into a certain degree as one of those products. So I'm curious what your reaction to that, them in the ecosystem, is.
Yeah, Microsoft is an incredible company. GitHub is awesome. I've been a GitHub user since 2008 and absolutely love the product. And we, with Code Search, had tons of customers that had their code on GitHub. But from an enterprise point of view, GitHub is way less dominant than they are in community. They basically own all of the open source community, but it's quite fragmented if you're looking at where is the code inside of a company. And all it took was, even if a company's code was 80% on GitHub, if they had 20% of their code on GitLab or Bitbucket or somewhere else, or even a different GitHub instance, then you need to have something that looks across all of those. So actually, one thing that we saw from our customers is GitHub's dominance was actually much less in the enterprise. And when we saw Copilot being created, I mean, it blew everyone's minds. But I think internally from GitHub, everything I've heard is they felt like they just created magic and it was crickets. Or in Hacker News comments, it was a bunch of people saying that this is terrible and this is the end of the world. And now I think history has proven them right, that they did build something truly incredible and truly magical. But it took a long time to actually get dev end user adoption. Although they had these incredible retention metrics from people that were using it, it's still just a massive behavior change. So We were keeping close eye on it. We were starting to introduce embeddings-based search into code search because that felt like more in the kind of code search wheelhouse. But it was working with Anthropic about, you know, more than 2 years ago before ChatGPT, where they had the Claude model, and it was the kind of model that really changed the world that goes way beyond the Codex models that could do, you know, a single line completion. And we just were absolutely having our minds blown by what you could get if you had code context from code search and you fed it to one of these chat powered LLMs. You know, now it's called like RAG, but it's a pretty obvious technique. And we were working at Anthropic at the time because we thought, you know, OpenAI, it's an amazing company, but they're so close to Microsoft. Are they going to be a good partner? We weren't quite sure. It turns out Anthropic has been an incredible partner. OpenAI has been an incredible partner. And really every model creator has been. And I love that about the AI community. People are so open to sharing how things are done. There's so much open source. And there's none of the, you know, I'm going to keep my cards close to the chest. So we were definitely monitoring Copilot, but really the world changed when the I would say, chat-powered LLMs, the kind that led to Claude and ChatGPT came out. And that's where we were really fast on that. And we had, you know, an early attempt at building something great. And then it's just been a ton of lessons since then.
This kind of goes off of your open source point that you mentioned as well. So I guess, how does SourceGraph engage with and also support the open source ecosystem? And then I guess, what trends do you see in the future of open source software, given the space of AI adoption?
We love open source. I contribute to open source all the time. Cody is open source. So, you know, not only is it the second biggest code AI product by revenue, second to GitHub Copilot, but it's also open source. So you can go check that out. And with open source, what I think is really interesting is all the open source models that have come out. I mean, that did not have to happen. That was something that these models take a ton of money to train. They could have just been kept internal, but I'm so happy that you see that. And you see Meta, you see Google really pushing on open source. So that's fantastic. And for us, and what that means for the model ecosystem is, you know, you cannot just have one model. There's not one model to rule them all. You're constantly seeing this model is now the best, or this one's the best, or this one is now open source and free and it's good enough. And for end users and for companies like us, that creates incredible competitive pressure from all these companies that are training models so that we can get something that costs hundreds of millions of dollars to train and our overall spend on AI inference is quite low. That means, you know, that we can make this broadly available. But also we've made Cody actually provide free state-of-the-art models to free users. We've got some pretty high rate limits, but we offer that to anyone. So anyone working on open source, any hobbyists, they can get Claude 3.5 Sonnet. They can get, you know, some of the other leading models for free. And that would not have happened if not for the competitive pressure that all these open source model releases created. So I'm a huge lover of open source. I think it's done so much. And I just keep thinking that it didn't have to be this way. Back in the 90s, there was not open source in this way. And it's just a few people that had such a big impact and have led to so much innovation and rate of progress. Really grateful for it.
Yeah. I'm curious as well, are y'all back to like how much innovation is happening? I think this is one of the challenges that people are struggling with right now. There's actually a lot of great models and it's like difficult to stay on top of like, you know, whose model is best for what use cases. I think like coding is maybe an example of this. How are y'all internally, and you know, you don't have to go into all the details or just as a high level thought framework if you want to, evaluating like what models are working best? Is it like A/B tests with different customers? Or I'm curious like what, or just like you have eval sets around like representative coding use cases that you're using internally today?
I think this is an area where every company needs to get a lot more sophisticated, but at least for autocomplete, we have this really nice situation where you have a clear metric, completion acceptance rate, and some other things like weighted completion acceptance rate and daily completions per user, where you can actually see the impact of different models on user behavior. That is where we've done a lot of work to fine tune models, to try a bunch of different models. Like, you know, initially it was Star Coder and we've used a lot of the Instant or Turbo models for autocomplete. We've got a lot of data around that. Where it's a lot harder though is chat, because chat is this ultimate open-ended kind of bucket for all the other things that we didn't have a specific feature for. Then you go to chat and it's been a real struggle to do good evals for chat. We've got some context fetching evals for chat that are quite useful just to see, hey, given this query, did we fetch the right context? That's a lot easier to construct, but it's been a lot harder to do that for chat. And our strategy has been to do intent detection, look at how are people using chat, and then try to carve out the biggest kind of use case buckets into more first-class features for the user, so that then we can have some kind of structure to know, did they actually insert this code if that's what they're supposed to do, or did they, you know, accept it? Or, you know, the holy grail ultimately is knowing, did we write code that passed tests? And ultimately, did we write code that increased revenue for our customers? And that sounds crazy, but there's a lot of e-commerce sites that we work with that have these incredible instrumentation systems that will tell them for this A/B test, this increased revenue. And that is the kind of, you know, foundation that you need to actually give some AI system input that helps them create an objective function for an agent to go autonomously and write a bunch of code, try 1,000 different things, and iterate toward greater and greater success. So I've been really interested in these companies that do have really sophisticated A/B testing frameworks that tie to revenue, because that's where I think that agents will actually work. And frankly, right now, they don't work, although it's a really cool area to be exploring.
Yeah. What's your feeling about some of these general purpose models? And I think you need a general purpose model specifically perhaps for the chat use case, but maybe for the autocomplete use case, like why, and maybe the answer is you are doing this, but like, why are more people not using like custom code models? Like there's been a bunch of open source code models. Like there was originally, I think OpenAI had the code model that they made accessible, but it seems like people have actually moved away from that direction. And it's more so like, let's just make a general purpose text model that is really great at all use cases. And it'll hopefully be good at code as well. Do you have an intuition behind why people have focused in one way or the other?
Yeah, it does seem strange to me that there's a lot of models that purport to be for code autocomplete that don't support fill in the middle. That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think, though, that everything is so early and people who are in it don't appreciate quite how early it is. I ran some numbers and can share the link to the conference talk I gave. But based on the numbers that I can find, about 5% of professional developers are using code AI. That's 5%. So in a room of 20 people, only one person is using code AI. And most of that usage is on autocomplete. So all these companies building code AI, us included, we've been able to see a ton of growth of these early adopters without having to go and actually make it work for that dev using Scala, or, you know, for this dev working on Java code that's kind of archaic, that the model, you know, kind of basic model trained on basic tokens on the internet is not going to work well on. But now that we're getting past that first 5% early adopters, we are seeing from our customers requests like, hey, we have a ton of Scala code and this doesn't work well in Scala or Rust. And we are having to do a lot more fine-tuned model work. We're having to do a lot more kind of, you know, I would say eating your broccoli, making this shit actually work and get people to daily use it. And I think you're going to see more of that, more precision, more evals, more rigor that is going to lead to a lot more of this kind of development as people get beyond that like 5% early adopters who frankly could see some great text and it could be totally wrong. And they're going to go just think that this is the most amazing thing. We're getting to the people that are cynical and that's going to feel really tough. It's going to feel like adoption is slowing down and all that, but it's ultimately what's good because all of these trillions of dollars that have gone into all these AI companies, they're not going to get a return unless we can get way more than 5% of devs using code AI.
I was just saying, I'm just kind of curious as far as you say, obviously there's like a 5% of developers are early adopters. Why isn't that more? Again, it seems like a no-brainer to me. And I feel like this is a common thread with all the conversations we're having. It's like, if you have this tool that is going to make your life easier, you know, why are people hesitant to jump on board and use an automation tool such as, you know, Cody?
Yeah, I think it's crazy. I think we all think it's crazy. But remember when Copilot came out back in 2021? Did you immediately start using it? I'm actually curious. Did you?
No. Took a little.
Me neither.
I think I started using it, but it just wasn't. The code completion to me still seems like it's less of the, I don't know. I feel like I've been trained by chat too much now where like code completion just like feels a little weird comparative to chat.
Do you think it's more so also folks that want, like, don't trust? I feel like obviously trust plays a big factor into it as well, right? It's like for folks who've been doing this year after year who, you know, are at the top of their game as far as this, you know, maybe it's a little hesitancy as far as, right, do I want to give the reins over to someone where I don't have, or I have less control, which I guess is, you know, probably an interesting take. And I guess off that as well, you know, as more and more people do adopt, I guess the question to you is, how do you see the role of developers changing over the next decade? And I guess with that, you know, what are some skills that would be most crucial to folks to thrive in that space?
The job of a developer is changing all the time. So there's nothing new. And I think that people will adapt. Look, if you were coding today the same way that you were coding 10 years ago, you would be out of a job. The job is completely turned over in most cases. I mean, there's no profession that I'm aware of that changes as quickly, and you got to stay up to date on as much as software development. So I think with AI, the pace is going to increase. But what I love about AI is it seems to accentuate all of the characteristics of people and programmers that I consider virtuous. So if there's someone who's a junior dev who might be worried, well, one, even the fact that they're thinking about it means they're probably in the top 5% of their cohort. And if they have got high agency, if they're willing to work hard, they basically have a 24/7 constantly available free, nearly free mentor for all of their programming questions. And so if you are that person with those virtuous characteristics, you're going to be the beneficiary. And then all of the consumers on the other end, a lot of times when people look at some economic phenomenon, they just look at how does this affect the people that are working in it. But everyone is a consumer, and think about all of the additional technology, the software that's going to make everyone's lives better that we're going to get because of this. And that is the kind of thing that raises, that rises all boats. So I think people will be fine as long as they have those characteristics. But if you're no one identifies as a lazy programmer, but the lazy programmers are going to be under a lot more pressure. And if you are a lazy programmer personally, I don't know how you don't just have your eyes wide with wonder about what you can do with code. And if you're lazy as a programmer, I think probably you should be in a different field. So I think it'll be fun.
And then I don't know if you have thoughts on this, and I'm curious, we could scrap it if it doesn't make sense, but to your point about how things are constantly changing, how do we on the front end as far as education goes, put ourselves in a best position to, future developers, how do we teach them with the right tools, knowing that, over the next course of the next 24 months or so, things are going to be changing rapidly? I guess, how do you stay ahead of that curve for people who are either, early on in their careers or looking to get in this space? I'm curious what your thoughts would be on that.
I see more junior devs adopting AI at a much faster rate than senior devs in general. And I don't think that they have a problem there. I would say look to their peers and how are other people in their cohort using AI. I think it's pretty natural to say, here's a chat that can answer pretty much any programming question, especially the kind that junior devs have, which tend to be more basic and less about the specific complex enterprise code base, because a lot of the times these people are working on smaller code bases that are not yet getting into, 30 years of legacy nuance. So you've got something that is an oracle that can answer your question. So just keep on using that. And I think that's going to guide you. And even if you don't have some amazing, deep, unique way of using this, just the fact that you're using it means you're in the top 5% of all programmers in the world, and your rate of progression is going to be so much faster. And as programmers, we know that it takes such a long time. It takes so many hours of coding to get good. But every hour that you are coding with an AI assistant, I think that it's probably worth like 5 hours of doing that in the dark ages before we had that. So I think the kids will be fine.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about them.
It's the senior devs that you're worried about.
Yeah. If there's someone who, Nolan, as you said, is not trusting of the AI and they have that kind of mindset, well, I mean, that person probably struggles in the workplace today because they're probably also not trusting of other developers, of junior developers. They're probably the kind of grumpy devs that give these really nitpicky code review comments. And I think you got to change that mindset. I mean, code is a living and breathing thing. You're going to push bugs. You have to always be thinking, what's the trade-off between reliability and progress? So that's just a mindset that you got to shift. And you see this alien technology of an oracle that knows so much about code, that can do so many amazing things. And you cannot end the conversation with, hey, I don't trust it. You got to be figuring out, how do I get it to produce the right output? And the companies that we've seen that have done the best at code AI adoption, and as a result, are moving much faster, are the ones where the CEO has literally come in and said, everyone's got to use this. If you're a dev who works here and you're not using some kind of code AI, then you don't have a role here. And by the way, it's going to give you the wrong answer. And you need to figure out how to make it give you the right answer. That kind of top-down guidance has been more valuable than anything. Databricks and Ali, the CEO over there, is one example of a CEO who's done that. I think that gives these senior engineers either the permission or the right kick in the pants to go and adopt this with the requisite gusto.
Yeah, I love that. One more sort of similar line of thinking question to this. There's this whole controversy about people who don't code and have never coded being like, oh, you shouldn't learn how to code in the future if you're, you know, in high school right now or something like that, and you should go and learn calligraphy or whatever the people in the future are going to be doing. I'm curious sort of that line of questioning about, like, should people still be learning how to code? And also, like, does like the maybe the net number of developers in the world change significantly because of like the advancements of some of these code AI tools? Like, is it going to increase, decrease the number of developers that that are in the world? Not a trick question, just
all these people that are wondering about should the students learn to code, the only people that I hear that worry from are parents. I don't hear that from any people that are actually in college or around there. They're not listening to those people anyway, and I think that's how it should be. So I think that's just a lot of noise and can tune it out. I think if you think that coding seems really cool, if you think it solves problems for you, then yeah, absolutely learn to code. And learning to code doesn't need to mean going and doing a 4-year computer science degree. It can mean going and asking a code AI assistant, hey, how do I make this chart? So, you know, the activation energy has been dramatically reduced. And that's exactly the answer to what is going to happen to the number of software developers in the world. The numbers that I've seen are generally around 40 million professional developers in the world full-time, and around 100 to 150 million people that are coding in some part of their job. Think of like financial analysts, data analysts, and so on. And for me, there's an example that's really near and dear to my heart. My wife is an AE at Google. She sells ads. She's in the belly of the beast there. And for her clients, she has to make a lot of charts and analyses, and she'll use Google's internal code search. She'll use their AI stuff. And she is not a coder. She has no computer science degree whatsoever, but she is getting more and more, closer to the code as a result of the technologies that Google has internally. So I think you're going to see that increase. And we started the company SourceGraph with this vision of making it so that everyone codes. And for a long time, people were like, how the hell are you going to do that? But now with AI, I think it's clear how in the future we could have everyone coding, or at least conjuring up code. They might not know it, but they're going to be creating software that solves their problems. We're still far away from having all 8 billion people doing that. But I think the number of people that are writing code and participating in that global graphic code is going to go way, way, way up. Just like as you saw with reading and writing. I think back in 1492, before the Gutenberg press, it was a crazy idea that everyone would be participating. You know, what would the average person even have to say? And there's no way that they learn to read amid all the farming that they must do. But clearly, there's something that happened that was completely unforeseeable. So we don't know exactly how it's going to unfold, but we've at least got some of the fundamental building blocks that can make it so that everyone could code in the future, which is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I love that vision. I'm curious to hear your perspective on some of the interface problem or challenge or just direction that we're going from an AI tool perspective. I think sort of the conventional wisdom right now is, you know, chat is essentially the interface that everyone's interacting with AI. I think in an IDE, you can obviously do some things. There's standard practices around completion and other stuff like that. I'm curious, like, how you see this, like, taking the next step, whether it's agentic behavior or something like that, to sort of break out of that chat format, or maybe for code and stuff, chat format is the direction that we should be pushing it. I'm curious where your thoughts are.
Building an interface in a real product that actually gets daily usage by tons and tons of people that involves AI has been a total mind fuck for everyone involved. So many false starts, so many mistakes, so many instances where I look back and I'm like, how are we so dumb? Or why did we not make that change sooner? And the root of it is that everyone got spoiled, because the very first modality for code AI was autocomplete, and you could not invent a more perfect way to introduce AI. It's something that is for software developers who already have familiarity with how these tools work. It is something where the human is in the loop, and it's something that the models are really good at. And those three things, those do not apply to, you know, most kinds of AI tools. And we got spoiled, because then, you know, everyone tried chat. We tried chat, and you had the hallucination problem. And then you had RAG, and people talked about RAG for a whole year without actually doing any kinds of evals or looking at, like, how are they doing chunking or how are they doing re-ranking? And it's just a cargo cult that happened for a long time. So what we have found to be the most important principle is you got to make it work manually first before you introduce any kind of magic. And so for RAG specifically, like to be really concrete, that means make it so that people can at mention things, explicit at mentions of documents to bring in before you do any kind of automatic RAG. And just doing that would make so many existing products better, but it feels less magic. And you know, one of the really bad and tempting things is any AI product for the longest time, not anymore, could have a slick demo, and that would give the false feeling of validation. So we've adopted this really hard rule at Sourcegraph that you got to make it work manually first before you add any kind of magic. And there's even areas where we thought that we had rooted all the magic out where there's still magic. Like generate unit tests is an example in Kodi. We have this awesome generate unit test where you can just right click in your editor and say generate unit test, and it's just going to start writing the test file. It'll find an existing test file, or it'll create a new one, and it'll detect your framework. And we busted our asses and made it work for a ton of different frameworks. And still our customers would say, hey, this doesn't work for, you know, some obscure Java framework that we had never anticipated. And what we saw is so many of our customers would just go to chat. And this is where chat is this beautiful fallback. If we didn't have a first class way of making it work, then they have this fallback. And we're actually ripping out all of this kind of magic that we introduced in generate unit tests and actually having a Mad Lib style interface where if you want to generate a unit test, it's going to pop you in a chat. It's going to say, you know, please generate a unit test using this framework. And that's going to be a placeholder. We're going to do our best to guess at what that should be, but you can always go and change that. And then it turns out a really valuable thing is for the user to show us one or two other test files that are similar to the one that they want Kodi to write. And we could do that automatically. And, you know, we can guess. But if the user can spend 30 seconds giving that kind of input, the whole idea is a unit test that it generates is going to save 30 minutes. And this is going to give a much better unit test in the end. So that's worth it. And that feels like it's violating every single tenet of AI. Oh, it should be magical. It should be automatic. Well, there's a research paper over here that says actually, you know, unit test generation is one of the best things that AI models are done. And it's done in like one language for one framework by like some random researchers that I wouldn't necessarily trust if I was talking to them live. You got to just resist that pull for the magic, and you got to build a manual way first. Make that work, because these models are incredible. They're incredible at taking some examples and some basic prompts and doing incredible things from that. And if you get in the user's damn way, they are right to be really pissed off. And it's hard though, because it feels like you are not in the AI cool kids crowd. You are ignoring the research, but ultimately DAU and revenue does not lie. And it's all about DAU in the end. And if people are not using this shit, then it doesn't matter. So that's been the absolute mindfuck. And even having said this, I'm sure that there's going to be more places that we are going to find in our product where we've got magic, or where we can reduce the magic even more.
I have a really quick follow-up. How important is the code graph in solving sort of the maybe it's important in the autocomplete case, but like in the more chat case, like is having a graph of the code like a critical differentiator for you all, or is that sort of just like the, and I ask this because I'm naive and I don't know, or is that just like the normal path that folks would use to solve the more like code chat use case?
Yeah, you know, code search is think like full text search over the code, you know, with some structure, and the code graph is context, like what are all the references or calls to this function, or if you're asking about, you know, a certain piece of code, then do a go to definition on the functions mentioned and include those function bodies when you're asking a question about it. And frankly, we thought that that would be like the a really important thing. We did some experiments around that. We have some experiments in Kodi right now, and that's on for some users, but that hasn't been the silver bullet that we thought so far, just because of a few kind of operational things. It can be slow. It can be hard to do that. That's very language specific. And we're still at the phase where with 5% of pro devs using this stuff, they're not yet getting into these like super advanced needs. And the workaround right now is if you're not in the experiment that has this enabled in Kodi, just at mention another file. And that always works. That's really legible to the user. We will introduce the like additional magic of pulling in definitions and references, making them at mentionable in the future. But really, it's just the manual stuff that is where there's a lot more work to be done.
This is off on kind of a different train of thought, and it popped in my mind a little earlier, and I wanted to share because I love both your feedback. But I feel like, again, with Cody, with SourceGraph, you're basically reducing the hurdle for individuals to go and create their own software. And I think, you know, based on the news that you hear with all these large tech companies who are laying folks off, I'm very interested to get your perspective. And it sounds like obviously some of your first customers were large organizations, but now, what do you think the impact will be with this automation as far as individuals who will go start their small to medium-sized business in software, again, have the tools that allows them to accomplish the things they could do with, you know, four or five developers? But again, just thinking from my perspective, right? Like I would love to start a company. I think the biggest hurdle if I wanted to would be writing that code and getting something off the ground and running. And again, with a tool like this, it kind of allows you to do so. So I'm just curious to hear, yeah, kind of your thoughts on the, you know, moving forward, are we going to see more small to medium-sized businesses appear? How will they play factor in that competitive market? You know, I think there's a lot of different variables in play, but at a high level, would like to get, you know, your thoughts on that. Same with you, Logan. I feel like it's a very, very interesting concept that we're going through and almost like a shift in what work might look like, you know, moving forward.
Yeah. What do you think, Logan?
I'm a subscriber to Sam Altman's point of view on this, which is like, it is very likely that we'll end up with like many, or at least starting to see these like one person billion-dollar companies, like the indie hacker who, you know, is doing $5,000 a month in revenue, like now sort of has this technology in their hands and they are going to be able to scale up even beyond that. And I think for people who don't have that like indie hacker persona, I think, you know, Nolan, if you're not writing code, I think Quinn, back to your point, I think there's people will be controlling code. I think whether or not they're like actually the ones who are writing it, it's so exciting. I feel like, at least for me personally, like the order of magnitude of problems that I'm able to solve is like 10x as ambitious. And I think that's with like the current level of capability of tools, and you sort of extrapolate like 3 or 4 years out into the future, and it's just going to be even more, which is so exciting.
Yeah, agreed. There's a lot of people that would be awesome at starting a company or just building a product on their own, starting something new, but they're not able to because either they don't know how to hire or they don't know how to raise capital. And AI makes it so they don't need to do either of those things. And that means more people with these great ideas that are going to be unshackled from the shackles that previously existed. So more awesome products that hopefully we'll find really useful. I love it.
I guess off that too, I mean, when perspective, do you think that, I mean, going back to your Uber, you know, as a customer wise, obviously they have a huge team compared to a team that say is in a small business with five, you know, basically, I mean, obviously output's going to be less because there's less folks working, but they'd basically be on the same playing field, correct? As far as what they'd be able to accomplish?
Well, basically is doing a lot of work in that sentence. I think that both of the companies will have their productivity increase significantly. But I believe that a lot of people in the AI space just take it as a given that like, oh yeah, agents are here and they work, and they see like a 30% performance on the Suebench benchmark. I mean, no, they are clearly the future, but they are not here yet. And I am worried about the hype around agents taking focus away from the hard work that everyone's got to be doing today to make the damn AI products work and get actual DAUs. And I'm worried about the hype around agents creating a lot of disillusionment among everyone, kind of like we saw with self-driving cars. I live in San Francisco. We have self-driving cars driving all around, and that should be an absolutely mind-blowing achievement. People should be celebrating that worldwide, like putting a man on the moon. And because there is all this disillusionment, because people have been talking about it forever, it's kind of like, people are doubtful about it. I mean, look, with agents, it's like these car company executives that like 20 years ago said, oh, the car of the future is a car that has no steering wheel. And they'd get up on stage and they'd point at some dumb looking concept car. And it's like, yeah, no shit, that's the future. But you're not going to get us there by just pointing at that dumb looking car. You're going to get us there by like basically what Elon did, building a shit ton of cars, putting a steering wheel in them, collecting data, iterating. And the first 1% of automation should not be like city driving. It should be like the dumbest highway driving when even humans can kind of nod off. And that's why this idea of an agent is just way premature. I'm glad that there are some research teams working on it, but it's way premature. And there's so much that's got to be done today. I mean, make inline edits better. Make it so that chat responses actually return code that's been type checked and that passes tests, and do that for like a year and get 1 million people using that and have it work across a lot of different languages. And then you can think about an agent. But it's just completely insane to me. People are getting way ahead of their skis, and I'm really worried about what that means for what people are actually building and focusing on, what gets adoration on Twitter, where the capital goes, and then what it's going to do to everyone when they realize 2 years from now we spent billions of dollars on agents and have nothing to show for it. People are going to say, hey, this is all a bunch of bullshit. I don't want that to happen.
Yeah, I think agents is going to end up being the, of all of the AI stuff that happens, like the largest evisceration of venture capital dollars in sort of history. Like there's so much money that has been poured into agent stuff. And by and large, it's everyone pretty much trying to do the same stuff with like no clear... Quinn, I totally agree with your line of thinking of like, just get actual things to work. I'm curious, like, what some of the, and you mentioned a couple of them in the comment that you just made, but are there other like things that from a model capability, the models just aren't able to do that are like really limiting? And maybe we can talk specifically about like code use cases that you wish, you know, if you could wave the magic wand, all of the AI labs would go and solve these three problems or whatever it is. And then that would make your life as a product builder 10 times better.
No, I don't think the bottleneck is the foundation models. I think it's great that those are getting better and better. 3.5 Sonnet is absolutely amazing. Love that Gemini Flash and Pro are amazing. And, you know, both are incredibly affordable. So that's all good. But there's a lot of agentic behavior that we could have today if we change the mindset. Like, think of you're coding something, and what are the dumb things that you hate doing? Like, generate unit tests, but even something simpler than that. You know, every company's got a different way of updating the change log. And it's intuitively obvious that AI could take your diff, and if it knew where to put the changelog entry in, if it could just do that for you automatically. And there's probably like 10 dumb things like that that each account for 0.2% of your programming time, and have the agent start to build up stuff like that. That is where, you know, that's an agent that lives in the editor. That's kind of the analogy to the Tesla autopilot doing the highway driving at first. That does not require any further model improvements. Probably could be done with GPT 3.5 even. And, you know, let's go and actually get that rolled out to a million users, have it generating 100 million ARR of enterprise revenue. And then, you know, maybe then we'll see where the bottlenecks are with foundation model research. But there's so much that could be done if you have the ability for a model, getting beyond like the changelog case, you have the ability for a model to make a small edit to code and quickly get feedback from the real world as to whether that change is correct or even more correct than some other change. And that's a way where you can really narrow the search space. So instead of having to one shot an entire application or having the model review its own code, bring in some ground truth. Did the test pass? Does it type check? You know, again, that example of for an e-commerce site, does it actually increase revenue? All of that stuff right now takes on the order of hours or days. But if you had a test suite that could, in 500 milliseconds, run all the tests for just the change portion of code, feed that back in, then you'd have the ability to run a state-of-the-art model today 1,000 or 1,000,000 times behind the scenes. And no one has even done that. And the reason why is not any AI reason. It's a dumb reason that everyone's CI is slow and test frameworks are janky. And that's where I think people should be exploring. And I think that the current generation of models will be able to do amazing things in that kind of framework.
That makes a lot of sense. Do you think people are too focused on like, because of the potential of the technology, there's like this whole order of like, you know, AGI, super ambitious problems that could be solved. And people are like, well, you know, do I really want to solve this like seemingly quote unquote boring or trivial problem? Or like, maybe I should just swing for the fences of, you know, an agent that's going to automate your whole life for you. When like really the practical enterprise value, DAU, you know, revenue is accrued by solving those less exciting, like more near-term problems. Is it like that? Is it the zeitgeist of the AI ecosystem that's kind of pushing people in the wrong direction as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is a lot of belief that the next model will make this irrelevant. And it's not as cool to be doing the eating the broccoli work that actually gets DAU, daily active users, that gets enterprise revenue. But that's what's needed. But there's something else too, which is, I don't think it's just that trade-off. If you have an advanced model, like all else being equal, it is going to be able to do a lot more if you run it in an iterative fashion with ground truth introduced versus just doing it one shot. I don't think that the next model or a future model is going to collapse the difference between those two ways of running it. So even if we do have AGI, I mean, you know, if it's AGI that's like 140 IQ, well, maybe it could get to 180 IQ if you can introduce ground truth. I mean, humans, we learn from our environment. Can you imagine if you were to go off in a wood cabin for 5 years and try to come up with, you know, progress? No, you need to be out there. You need to be getting feedback from the outside world. So I don't think it's just, you know, oh, people should be doing the boring thing. It's no, this is how you build truly amazing things, by bringing in ground truth and iterating.
I love that. That leads me to back to sort of part of the conversation we were having before around interfaces. I'm curious, have y'all explored like outside of the IDE workflows and like how you can sort of start to get some of that ground truth or additional context that doesn't exist in an IDE? And you can imagine like an email that the CI job is finished or whatever it is, a piece of feedback from a customer coming in through your customer feedback portal. Have you tried to sort of integrate those bits into the systems yet?
Yeah, that's been a huge push for us. I mean, ultimately any tool that a human developer needs to go to in the course of their job, our presumption is that AI might need to tap that information. So we wanted to build it as broad as possible. We created this open source, open standard called OpenCTX that is a way to bring in context from all these other tools. So in Kodi, it's experimental, but you can at mention stuff from Jira or Confluence or Datadog or Sentry or even like Azure Work Items. Like there's this whole massive set of tools where now you can at mention specific documents and bring that into Kodi. And other AI tools could also implement clients of that too. So, you know, we want to make it open. And for us, the behemoth in the room is Microsoft's GitHub Copilot. I love that team. They're incredibly smart. They've done amazing things. I'm so grateful for them. But I believe that if GitHub Copilot wins, then we're going to go back to the 1990s where it was a Microsoft closed ecosystem. And they're going to prioritize integrating with all the other Microsoft tools, which many of them are good, but many of them are not best in class. And that's a huge threat to every single other company other than Microsoft. That's a threat to Google Cloud. That's a threat to AWS. That's a threat to Atlassian. That's a threat to Datadog. We have this vision of having your AI be able to tap information from all the tools that you choose to use that are the best tools that are out there. And that's where, you know, we want to be aligned with the whole free world against the behemoth in this space. So not only is context an awesome thing for users today, but it's absolutely critical for AI to be really good. Because, you know, I think we want to be in a world where there's people that are building awesome dev tools other than Microsoft.
I guess quick question, and you kind of hit on it there, but I always like to ask builders and founders in the space currently, you know, how do you distinguish a competitive advantage or a competitive moat, especially in a space, like you said, you know, there's Copilot, there's Devin, you know, what would you say? And I guess this might be an opportunity for you to speak with our audience as far as why Kodi and SourceGraph is different. You know, what is your kind of quick pitch as far as, you know, why folks should be using Kodi?
Kodi brings the best models and the best context to you in your choice of editor and on the web. So it's free. We've got a really generous free tier. And the reason why we can do that is because all it takes is a 1% chance of you loving it and mentioning it to your friend who works at a big enterprise, and then they pay us the big bucks. So it is the best Code AI product. I use it all the time. And if you have any complaints, any feedback whatsoever, then please share with us directly and we work really fast on it. You'll see us working in open source and you'll see tons of people that are out there on Twitter saying why they love it. We, you know, when you look at feature by feature, I think autocomplete, that's kind of table stakes. Like even if we had 30 times better autocomplete than something else, you wouldn't really be able to notice, but it's chat where you can really see that difference. And that's where having the best models and the best context. We have the best automatic context because of our code search. We know how to pull the right context from your code. And we have the best manual context. As I said, all the different other things you can at mention from all these other tools you use. And because we've got that enterprise backing, we've got a real business model. We can offer a very generous free tier, high token output limits and all of that, even to free users. So chat is where you're really going to see that difference.
No, that's awesome. Hopefully all of our listeners will go check it out if they have not checked it out before. Being cautious of everyone's time, I guess another question Logan and I like to ask, and this could be again from a work tech stack or a personal tech stack, but we always are curious to hear, you know, what tools are you personally using currently that you can share kind of with the audience to check out as well?
Longtime Emacs user. Spent half my life in VS Code. Now that's increasing. We recently adopted Linear internally for project tracking, and that's been amazing. We use TypeScript and Go, switched to Biome for linting. That's been a huge improvement. We, as a company, we've not been able to use a lot of the, we have a lot of self-hosted customers. We have a lot of customers that have incredible scale. And then we also have like sourcegraph.com with a million open source repos or more in the index. So we've had to deploy in a lot of different environments. So we've had to have a pretty standard kind of deployment situation, which is just like, hey, it needs Postgres and sometimes Redis to deploy. So, you know, we've been pretty boring in that realm, but I think it's good to be boring in choice of tech stack, the software that you build.
I love that. Quinn, one of the, as you were describing a couple minutes ago, some of the things like why Cody is differentiated, it gets me, it got me super excited. Also, it makes me sad now as as somebody working in a in an environment where there's like, you know, slightly less permissive use of external software. It makes it tough because I think there's so much interesting stuff happening from a developer ecosystem perspective. So I'm hopeful I'll get to try as an individual developer. But the question we always close out with is just around sort of where your head is at, you know, going into the end of this year and into early next year, with respect to like what's something in the AI ecosystem that you're really hopeful happens, you know, in the next year or before the end of this year, and also what's something that you're really hoping doesn't end up coming to fruition based on the current trends.
The thing that just gives me so much wonder in my eyes whenever I use it is Llama and local models. This idea that you can be on an airplane in the middle of nowhere and you have this knowledge base that fits on your laptop is amazing. Cody has supported a Llama. I think we're the first one to add support for it. And it's really good. So I want to see that continue to thrive. I want to see more people building real applications on top of a Llama, because it's one thing to, you know, see a new model drop and try it out, but it's another thing to actually build applications that can run on your desktop or on your mobile phone, you know, in the future, perhaps locally with a Llama. I mean, what a huge win for privacy and security and for competition, because all the model creators are equal in the Llama command line and the Llama marketplace. No one has preferential access. And I think what I really want to see is just continued competition at the model layer. I think that benefits everybody. You have some of the world's smartest researchers working really hard, ultimately, to make it so that through companies like us that build products for end users, that their models are the best. And it's an amazing thing that you can switch from one model to another, you know, for a pretty complex product within a few weeks. And in Cody, you can actually do a little drop down. You can choose among Gemini and OpenAI and Anthropic and Mixtral and all these other models. So I just want to see continued competition there. It's clearly those foundation model companies are doing incredibly well. They're growing revenue really fast, so they will be fine. And that continued competition just means that the space stays really healthy, that we can offer an affordable product to enterprises and to people, and that it keeps getting better and better, because you know, there's nothing like a little bit of competitive spirit that causes those researchers to work nights, to work weekends, to, you know, spend another $1 billion on GPUs and so on. I just absolutely love seeing that. And it's so thrilling. Stuff is moving faster than I've ever seen it moving in my, like, I don't know, 20 years of being in tech and coding. It's so exciting. Let's keep it that way.
I love that, Quinn. This was a wonderful conversation. I'm appreciative of you taking the time. I'm also super excited, as you are, about the future. Like, there's so much. Yeah, coding is one of those problem spaces that seems like I still feel that magic when I use an AI coding tool. And I think, like, partially in like a normal chat, like just asking a question is like kind of the magic has worn off a little bit. I think coding, because of like how hard of a problem it often is to solve some of these things, like it's just such a magical moment when it all, everything comes together and works. So I appreciate all the hard work that you're doing to create that magic for developers everywhere. And thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
Yeah. And same to you. Thanks for making it so that we have awesome models that we can use and get out to folks. And to everyone who's listening, thanks and happy coding.
Happy coding. Appreciate it, Quinn. Phenomenal conversation. Learned a lot.